Now, the designated parameters for this debate will be a 5-minute introduction, 10-minute opening arguments, 10-minute rebuttal, 5-minute closing remarks, and then you guys can call in at the bottom of the hour, and which, let me give you that number. It's 888-503-0802. You might want to write that down, okay? And the questions that you do ask, the debaters will have the opportunity to each respond to your question. So I guess without further ado, I guess what we'll do here, we'll start first with Alex White and his introduction, and then we'll move on from there. And I guess I'll be the timekeeper here. Alex?
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. All right, well, good night. Good evening there, Mr. Finley and Kent and the Internet audience. My name is Alex White. I work in psychological services in the state of Arkansas. And mostly I do IQ kind of testing, that sort of thing. So when you deal with psychology, a lot of times you deal with these kind of constructs kind of things, these kind of impalpable, these kind of intangible kind of things. And in dealing with those kind of things, I felt like I had a particular advantage or a particular interest in presenting evolution, because like psychological constructs and things, it's not directly observable. And that's why I've decided to debate Mr. Hoeland. I also teach at a small college in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I teach introductory psychology. And a lot of times I cover, like I said, these kind of abstract constructs and the basic scientific method and those kind of things. And those will pretty much be the core of my points tonight, will be centered around what is a science and how evolution is a science in that regard and not necessarily a religion. First, I want to remind everyone that I'm not a professional debater. In fact, this is my first public debate ever, so if Kent stumps me tonight, I've got a ready-made excuse. How do you like that? Our discussion tonight will focus on two premises that Kent professed when he was debating Massimo Pigliucci on this radio show a few months ago. Number one, Kent said that evolution is a religion and should not be taught in public schools because it is a violation of the 10th Amendment. Now, while I agree with him that religion should not be taught in public schools, I will present an argument tonight that is consistent with the idea that evolution is a non-religious scientific concept, and therefore not a religion, and should be taught in public schools. I also agree with Kent that no religion should be taught in public schools, therefore I'm going to make every attempt to refrain from criticizing any other religious views regarding the origin of man, because we both agree that it's not to be taught in public schools. I simply don't see that as within the scope of this debate. However, the title on Kent's website is Creation Science Evangelism, and I will address the view of Christian creationism being propounded as a science directly. The second premise that Kent professed in the Pigliucci debate was that time functions as a god for evolutionists, and I'll address that tonight as well. Okay, and on that note, I'll turn it over to Kent.
All right. Well, thank you, Alex. I'm glad you are willing to discuss the subject. I've been turned down over 3,000 times for debates, professors who do not want to debate on the creation-evolution topic for whatever reason. For those that may not know, I live in Pensacola, Florida. I taught high school science for 15 years, and now for almost 15 years, I've been an evangelist doing seminars all over the world on the subject of creation, evolution, and dinosaurs. My position is very simple. I do believe the Bible is literally true and scientifically accurate in every detail. Unless it's obviously an allegory, like if I say I'm hungry as a horse, it's obvious, you know, that's called a metaphor, it's similes. We have those in English and they have them in Hebrew also. But I believe the Bible is literally true, scientifically accurate. I believe the earth was created in 6 days, about 6,000 years ago. I think Adam and Eve were literal people who lived in a literal Garden of Eden. I think dinosaurs were just big lizards that lived with Adam and Eve. They used to be called dragons. They lived with man all through history. Man exterminated most of them. The word dinosaur was just invented in 1841, and so before that, in human history, they were known as dragons, and people killed most of them, and there could be a few stragglers still alive, like, you know, Loch Ness Monster or things like that. It's called cryptozoology, the study of hidden animals, and I believe we've really been brainwashed about dinosaurs. I believe the evolution theory, as is taught in our schools, is one of the dumbest and most dangerous ideas in the history of the world. There is no evidence at all that any animal ever produced a different kind of animal. If somebody wants to believe that a dog came from a non-dog or a human came from a non-human, they're welcome to believe that. I don't care what they believe. But that is purely a religious belief. There is no scientific evidence to support that whatsoever. And I would quickly point out that absolutely no fossils could count as evidence for anything as far as evolution goes. If you find a fossil in the dirt, all you know is it died. You don't know that it had any kids. Now, if you want to believe, capital B, believe, that it was able to produce different kinds of offspring, then you're welcome to believe that, but that now is evidence of your religion, not science. Science deals with things that we can observe and study and test and demonstrate. Evolution is none of those. Now, we need to define the word evolution, what we're talking about here, because this is very important. The word evolution has at least six different meanings or levels or stages, and so we'll define these carefully here at the beginning. One of them, number six of the ones I'll give, is indeed scientific. Now, these are spelled out on my website, drdino.com, D-R-D-I-N-O, and you're welcome to go there and look at it. The first five steps or stages or meanings of the word evolution are purely religious, must be taken totally on faith, and are absolutely devoid of any scientific evidence to support them. First of all, we would have to have what's called cosmic evolution. That is the origin of time, space, and matter. Commonly, the very puny answer they give to explain that is the so-called Big Bang, which is a big dud. It's a big farce. It didn't happen. It's imagination. If they want to believe it happened, well, that's great. I don't care what they believe. But don't call it science, because nobody's ever observed something come from nothing, which is what the Big Bang theory requires. You have to get matter, energy, and time and space coming from nothing. Now, the Bible says, in the beginning, God did it. That is very different than to say it did it by itself. The computer is nothing but natural components, but it didn't assemble itself. And so, yes, the Earth is nothing but natural components, but that doesn't mean it could assemble itself without an outside designer, like the computer had to have a designer. So, the first definition of the word evolution is cosmic evolution. I think that one is ludicrous. It's ridiculous. There's no evidence for it at all. It didn't happen. If they want to believe that, that's wonderful. You know, believe whatever you want. But it's a religion and has no business being taught in our school system in part of a science class. Possibly in a fairy tale class or a religion class, but not in a science class. Secondly, if the Big Bang theory is true, it only produced hydrogen and some helium maybe, then we have a very serious problem, which is never discussed, called chemical evolution. Where did all the different elements come from? There are 92 basic elements in the world, plus the synthetic ones, and if the Big Bang produced hydrogen, how on earth did we get all these other elements? That would be called chemical evolution. It's never discussed, and I have a huge collection. I'm sitting in the middle of my library now. I have a huge collection of textbooks. You just never see that. They just assume it happened. And they'll say, well, you know, in fusion, stars can fuse elements together and create heavier elements. Yes, I understand that, but you cannot fuse past iron. Check it out. So, to get from hydrogen to uranium is absolutely impossible. Now, if they want to believe it happened, well, that's just great. You just believe whatever you want to believe, but that is indeed a religion. Thirdly, the third meaning or definition or stage or step in the theory of evolution would have to be stellar or planetary evolution. Nobody has ever seen a star form. We've never seen a planet form. All of the proposed theories have fatal flaws in them, like the accretion theory that a bunch of dust got together. Well, Boyle's gas law blows that one away. The tighter you try to squeeze dust in it and particles, the greater the pressure becomes, and it heats it up and it drives it back away. So all the theories proposed for how stars form are ridiculous scientifically and totally without observation. Nobody's ever seen a star form. Now, we have seen a few spots get brighter in a couple of clouds up in the sky. A couple of clouds in the universe. That doesn't prove a star is forming. That proves a spot is getting brighter, which might mean there is a star behind the dust cloud and the dust is clearing. So there's never been one example of a star forming that's been demonstrated. There have been numerous examples, like one every 30 years, of stars blowing up, called a nova or supernova. And yet it's estimated just recently, the estimate came out, I believe it was on CNN, that they now think there are enough stars that we know about that every individual on Earth can own 11 trillion of them to yourself. And those are the ones we know about. We don't know about the ones that we don't know about. Fourthly, we'd have to have organic evolution, the origin of life. Somehow life has to get started from non-living material. The evolutionist is left back 2 centuries behind in his thinking. He still thinks spontaneous generation can happen, and it doesn't happen. But the thing that causes it to happen in their mind is their God called time. If you say, you know, how could this happen? The answer will always be, well, given enough time, and I predict we'll hear that phrase several times tonight from Alex Weiss, well, over millions of years, or given enough time, you know, he will appeal to time. As I've mentioned many times, time is their God. He's the one that's able to make it happen. Fifthly, we have what's called macroevolution.
Mr. Hoban, I'm sorry your time is up as far as the intro. Let's go ahead and start with, and thank you very much for your information. Alex White, 10 minutes. 10 minutes argument.
Okay. Insofar as what Kent was talking about as far as cosmic evolution, hopefully later on he'll give me a reference on that. I don't have a reference for that, and I'm really interested in knowing where he's getting that kind of information, because as far as I know, evolution doesn't really approach those kind of cosmic metaphysical things, or physical if you want to talk about it being the physical world, but that's a little bit of a rebuttal and I don't want to get into that. Okay, insofar as religion, evolution being a religion, I will begin with the U.S. Supreme Court case that justified the teaching of evolution being taught in the classroom. The case that struck down laws which prevent the theory of evolution being taught in public schools originated, ironically, from my state of Arkansas. In the case Epperson versus Arkansas in 1968, they stated the following. In the present case, there can be no doubt that Arkansas has sought to prevent its teachers from discussing the theory of evolution because it is contrary to the belief of some that the book of Genesis must be the exclusive source of doctrine as to the origin of man. No suggestion has been made that Arkansas's law may be justified by considerations of state policy other than the religious views of some of its citizens. It is clear that fundamentalist sectarian conviction was and is the law's reason for existence. End quote. While Kent argues his view that evolution violates the Tenth Amendment's separation of church and state in the issue of the origin of man separately, he tips his hand as to his real issue with the teaching of evolution because he invariably brings up his biblical doctrine, and you did hear that earlier. Even as far back as 1968, 12 laymen known as the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that evolution was not a religion because in the same case, they referenced Epperson versus Board of Education when they say, quote, neither a state nor the federal government can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion over another, end quote. If they felt evolution was a religion, then they would have struck it as a violation of this case, and they didn't. Now, this is getting into the scientific type of argument. There are four ways with which we gain knowledge about something. The four ways of knowing are authority, a priori, faith, and science, and these are what they are. Authority is simply when someone in the know tells you information about any given phenomenon. We accept a lot of things on authority because it's a very quick and dirty way to obtain knowledge about something. Our usual sources of intellectual authority are mom and dad, grandparents, instructors, clergymen, or people older than we are. As you might be able to infer, information coming from authority will have some sort of bias and may or may not be entirely accurate. The next method, a priori, that's when logic is used to arrive at an answer about things in the world. You use logic in this method. For example, if you're walking down the street and you see someone take a brick and throw it through the front of a store, then they take out a TV and walk off with it, you would logically assume that that person is stealing a TV. Now, you don't know 100% that they're stealing, but you can logically assume, based on similar observations, that that person is stealing. Logic doesn't always yield the right answer, though. Let's say that you have three football teams, Team A, Team B, and Team C. Team A beats Team C. Team B beats Team C. Okay, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Team A will beat Team C. Now, I know that these are some rudimentary examples, but the important thing to remember about a priori knowledge is that it is employed when the answer of your question or potential result hasn't been reached yet or is impossible to reach. Method number three, science is based on what is observable through the five senses. Scientific methods are used when at all possible to answer these a priori questions I referred to earlier. The ideal method for collecting information in the experiment is the experiment, but it's not always possible to employ. Other data collection methods are correlational studies and less formal measurement techniques. However, only an experiment can establish a causal link between two things or variables. That is, that one thing is causing the other to occur. You know this because when you change or manipulate one thing, you get a predictable change in the other thing. Now, another important tenet to science is that experiments and other evidence form the nuts and bolts of theories. Theories are a collection of conclusions that allow for explanation of certain concepts. This does not mean that there are never any experiments whose conclusions are in the opposite direction as the theory. The beauty of a theory is that it operates on a preponderance of the available evidence. Now, Kent may be able to find a book or two that contains some nebulous information or evidence that refutes various scientific theories or concepts. That doesn't mean that the experiments or evidence on which the theory, or even the contrary evidence, is based on is false or fabricated. Indeed, there may be some evidence out there that is contrary to the law of gravity or some other law of science, and it's up to the individual to make their determination as to the plausibility of the available evidence. Kent or anyone else is free to interpret the evidence however he wants, but that does not necessitate an abandonment of a theory if a greater amount of evidence supports the prevailing conclusion. Okay? That's how theories work. That's how science works. How are theories formed? Theories are formed by experts of a particular field, those individuals with technical skill competencies, and whose experts may come to different conclusions or theoretical speculations as to what is, quote, the true explanation, end quote. Indeed, paleoanthropology, the study, scientific study of fossils of man and man's descendants, is not devoid of differences of opinion regarding the interpretation of the available evidence, and I'll give you some examples of this later on. However, so far, I have yet to read any paleoanthropologist from Kent that agrees with his findings. And this either, of course, so far not yet, but in the debate with Massimo, I did not hear that either. Faith is a fourth way of knowing. Faith is when you simply know something is true because you have faith that it is. Faith defined is, quote, a confident belief in the truth, value, or trustworthiness of a person, idea, or thing, end quote. The second definition is better, I think, quote, a definition that does not rest on logical proof or material evidence, end quote. Now, I extracted these definitions from the American Heritage Dictionary, second college edition, published by Houghton Mifflin Company of Boston in 1985. Excuse me. That is faith defined. So, what this is saying is that things that can be supported by corroborating material evidence are not faith. Faith helps us out in a lot of ways. It reduces our anxiety about a lot of things, such as where do we come from, where are we going, things will get better no matter how bad they get, etc. These are all faith assumptions, or currently they're faith assumptions. But there is never any empirical evidence to derive to support any claims of faith, or it simply wouldn't be faith. Okay. The characteristics of evolution are, number one, superfecundity. Number two, natural variation among offspring. And number three, finally, natural selection. Okay? Superfecundity is the principle that organisms produce far more offspring than can reasonably survive. Number two, natural variation among offspring. The offspring of any species of organism will have a variation of genes within an observable range causing traits that may be more advantageous in some environments and less advantageous in other environments. Okay, in other words, you have a variation among the children. Number three, natural selection. Changes or stresses in the environment require different genetic characteristics for survival. It's important to note that these characteristics are genetic and cannot be acquired any other way. When organisms have changed sufficiently as to where there are consistent observable characteristic differences, a new species may be created. The delineators of a new species are, number one, a population of similar organisms. Similar, what does that mean, right? I'll talk about this later on. Number two, they interbreed in nature. Certainly you can get creatures to interbreed with each other morphologically similar. But to be a species, they must do it in the natural condition. And number three, they share a common gene pool. Again, how is common defined? I'll get to that later. What empirical evidence can we observe today that supports evolution? I can think of four great examples. Number one, for starters, there are fossils. Fossils that have been collected and dated in a way that supports a predictable range of age. Now, that's important. Neanderthal man was discovered in, almost 150 years ago in 1856, rather. Since then, there have been hundreds of thousands of fossils collected, nearly each one available for inspection of anyone else in the field with technical training seeking to question the authenticity or dating of any of these fossils.
2 minutes.
2 minutes? Okay, thank you. Number two, an important evidence for an evolutionary process is that of a mosquito pesticide called DDT. DDT was developed from a chemical that existed in Germany around 1900. During the summer of 1943, this chemical was renamed neosite and later referred to by its initials DDT for its chemical name. It was used in World War II to kill lice, typhus, moths, and most importantly, malaria-killing mosquitoes. It was so successful that an international campaign against malaria was launched. However, by 1953, some populations of mosquitoes were showing a resistance to DDT. This was evolution occurring right before our very eyes. Through natural variation of offspring, some mosquitoes were born with a stronger resistance to DDT. These mosquitoes survived the initial spray and were able to reproduce themselves, producing even a more resistant offspring. Okay, quote, this is, I'm quoting from a book here. Quote, 7 years was how long it seemed to take for resistance to arise in mosquitoes under attack from DDT and to become an insuperable obstacle to its continued use, end quote, leading to its eventual ban in the United States in 1972. We see the same mechanisms at work today in the use of antibiotics. The reason why we're always told to take all the antibiotics a doctor prescribes is because if we only take enough antibiotics to relieve our symptoms, through natural selection, the weakest bacterial cells have died, but the more resistant bacterial cells are left behind. Eventually, just like the case in mosquitoes and DDT, the same antibiotics will not kill what is now a totally resistant strain of bacteria. Then, different antibiotics are needed to fight off the infection. Occasionally, physicians are confronted with a strain that is already resistant to the first level of antibiotics, and the second or third level must already be needed to be employed. This is another simple yet definitive example that evolution is a very real phenomenon, and it's something that we can plainly observe today. All right. I ran out of time there, but that's all right. I'll try to address the rest of these in my rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Holden.
All right. Yes, sir. I think it would be important that I finish defining what the word evolution means, because obviously we have a miscommunication here based on the meaning of the word. I left off saying macroevolution is number 5 of the 6 that I give. This is where an animal changes from one kind into another. Nobody's ever observed this. I noticed tonight he was bringing up examples, Alex was bringing up examples that involve variations within the same kind of animal, like the mosquitoes becoming resistant to a pesticide or a bacteria becoming resistant to a drug. But this is still the same kind of animal. Nothing has really changed. Actually, the resistance was already in the gene code, just like when they dug up the guys that froze trying to find the Northwest Passage up in the Hudson Bay. This was several centuries ago. They froze to death up there, and when they dug them up and autopsied them, they found they were resistant to penicillin. A few of them were. Well, the problem is penicillin hadn't been developed yet. So the resistance was already in the creature. In this case, a mosquito was becoming resistant to DDT. It's true that a certain very small percentage of the mosquitoes had a natural resistance to DDT, and so when everything else was wiped out, those few survived, and they become the, parents of the entire next generation, which is much more likely now to have that same resistance. And after a few generations of that, you now have an entire population of mosquitoes resistant to DDT. This is not evolution. This is a slice of the gene pool that has now survived, and if you went to a different pesticide, you may find the different results. Those may die off, and some other ones may happen. Notice the mosquitoes did not ever become resistant to a sledgehammer or a blowtorch. They became resistant to something that was already in the gene code, and no new genetic information was added. And if that's the best example Mr. White has for evolution, then he really needs some help, because that is not an example of evolution. He said that was evolution in showing evolution before our eyes, his quote. Well, then you need to look at this differently. That is not evolution. The last meaning of the word evolution is what we call microevolution. That is variations within the same kind. Now, for instance, a dog, a wolf, and a coyote probably had a common ancestor. They are all listed as separate species, Canis lupus, Canis domesticus, Canis coyotes, or whatever you pronounce it. Anyway, but they are still interfertile. Now, it's true they don't normally breed in nature. They can. They normally don't. Alaska rabbits and Florida rabbits don't normally breed in nature either, because they're a long ways apart. But they could also. So I think that his definition of species, and the entire scientific definition of species, has always been extremely weak and very much subject to interpretation. There's never been a good solid definition of species. I think the biblical word kind is much better. The Bible says if they can bring forth, they are the same kind. So a horse and a zebra can bring forth. You can mate a horse and a zebra and get a zorse, or a zonkey, or a z-donk, or a shebra. Those types of animals, donkeys, asses, horses, breed all sorts of ways. You can crossbreed them, and there are groups in California that have competition. Who can get the weirdest-looking animal? They have giant horses, the Clydesdales, and little bitty tiny horses, the miniature horses. They're still a horse. They're still genetically a horse. They're still obviously recognizable as a horse. Sam, you could, probably dogs are a better example because so much has been done in the last few centuries trying to develop, you know, unusual traits in dogs. Okay, they're still a dog. That's not evolution. So when we refer to the minor changes like Mr. White referred to tonight, that's not really evolution, which is why you have to have a good definition of the word. What he referred to here tonight, the mosquito becoming resistant to pesticides, it's still a mosquito. A four-year-old knows it's still a mosquito. And if you think that is evidence that we all came from a rock 4.6 billion years ago, you really, really are dreaming. All of the examples given that are, that really have scientific empirical evidence to back them up, all of the examples fall into the microevolution category. And so I don't like the word microevolution. I think it's a mistake to use that because it gives the evolution theory what's called the free rider effect. People start to think, oh, there's evidence for evolution. I saw it, you know, a dog, you know, produced a new species. No, it's still a dog, okay. Great Danes and Chihuahuas probably had a common ancestor, a dog. Saltwater and freshwater crocodiles might have had a common ancestor. It was a crocodile. There are eight kinds of bears in the world today. They may have had a common ancestor. It was a bear. That does not prove bears and bananas are related. This is where the evolutionist imagination absolutely runs wild. They see these little bitty changes like mosquitoes becoming resistant to DDT and assume that that is evidence that we all came from a rock 4.6 billion years ago. So let me give you the evolutionist timeline as is taught in every public school textbook that I have on my shelf here, and it is hundreds of them. It may not be in every one, but if it discusses evolution, this is the scenario they give. They will say to the kids, 20 billion years ago, some say 15, some say 18, somewhere in there, long ago and far away anyway, there was a big bang where nothing exploded and produced everything. And then, about 4.6 billion years ago, the Earth cooled down and developed a hard, rocky crust. And as the rocks cooled, it began to, you know, produce volcanoes from the heat trying to escape, and the volcanoes produced steam, and this condensed as rain, and it rained on the rocks for millions of years and produced oceans. I can show you this in dozens of textbooks. This is precisely what they teach. They'll say the oceans formed as it rained on the rocks for millions of years. And then, so slowly, somehow, somewhere, long ago and far away, the melted rocks in the oceans, the dust and particles, the minerals out of the rocks, became a cosmic soup of some kind, and this soup came alive. And the first life form found somebody to marry and something to eat and slowly evolved into everything we see today. So this first life form, first place, wanted to reproduce its own kind, which is amazing to me. Why did all of the animals supposedly evolve the ability to reproduce? That would just be more mouths to feed. Why didn't they instead, evolve the ability to live forever? Then you don't have to worry about it. Then you got the whole world to yourself. So, anyway, the evolutionist wild imagination, they think these little minor examples they see of what's called microevolution is enough to prove that we all came from a rock 4.6 billion years ago. Now, I don't mind if Mr. White or anybody else wants to believe they came from Iraq. Honestly, that doesn't bother me. What does bother me is they want to use everybody's tax dollars to push that off in the public schools as if it is part of science, number one, and as if there are no other options, number two. Both of those are absolutely ludicrous. First place, there are several other options. Secondly, there is no scientific evidence to back up the idea that any animal ever came from a different kind of animal or produced a different kind of animal. And I'll stick with the biblical word kind. That they could bring forth. The mosquitoes that he's referring to that are resistant to DDT can still mate and bring forth with the mosquitoes that are not resistant to DDT. Nothing has changed. If they want to call that a new species, then they don't understand the definition of the word species. They don't understand it's still the same kind of animal. And I'm telling you, every four-year-old in Arkansas can tell you it's the same kind of animal just by looking at it. So all of the examples ever given for evolution fit into the microevolution category, number six of my six meanings of the word evolution. There are never any examples given of the first five. They are just assumed. And Mr. White mentioned that he did not think that, you know, cosmic evolution fit into the story. I'm telling you, it has to.
2 minutes.
you have to have something to evolve. You know, what they'd like to do, and what I'm sure is going to happen tonight, he's going to try to just skip over, gloss over the first few meanings of the word evolution that I gave, as if it's not part of the argument. They're going to say, well, we're going to start with living things, and then, you know, living things produce more offspring than can survive, which was Thomas Malthus's idea, and then that these living, you know, natural selection will select the strongest to survive, which was Darwin's, you know, theory, that natural selection is the magic thing to make it happen. And he's going to try to gloss over the fact that where did these living things come from, and where did the matter come from, and the laws come from, and the energy come from. They're just going to try to dazzle you with little bitty silly ideas like mosquitoes becoming resistant to bacteria or becoming resistant to DDT, and so that you won't even think about, you just skipped over four major obstacles. Matter creating itself, chemicals evolving to higher chemicals, stars evolving and planets evolving. Nobody's ever seen that. And then life coming from non-living material, spontaneous generation. That was proven wrong years ago by Francisco Redi and Louis Pasteur, and if you believe it happened, you're welcome to believe that, but you're two centuries behind on your science, and you're dreaming. You're teaching a fairy tale for grown-ups. You're not teaching science if you're teaching evolution. So when we discuss evolution tonight, we're talking about the first five meanings I gave, not minor changes within the kind. And in his imagination, apparently, mosquitoes becoming resistant or bacteria becoming resistant to drugs is evolution. Well, then you just really don't understand what the word means. What you gave are examples that the creationists would agree with. The Bible says they bring forth after their kind, and the bacteria are still bringing forth bacteria. So, that's my final answer.
All right. Thank you, Kent Hovind. Okay, Alex, a 10-minute rebuttal, please.
Okay, thank you. All right, earlier I said that science relies on things that are observable within the five senses. However, there are many things that can't be directly observed, but only with the proper instrumentation can they be observed or measured. It is common practice of every science to construct explanatory models or theories based on its observable phenomena. All right, some well-known examples are the heliocentric theory of planetary motion. You can't see that. The electromagnetic field, gravitation, you certainly can't see gravity, quantum physics, velocity, and most things within my discipline of psychology. Only with proper instrumentation can you observe any of these things. Kent said before that he believes in physical science, in the debate with Massimo, I should say, but I'll bet you he has never seen any stuff called gravity. Kent would also have us believe that evolution is not a science because we cannot observe the process. It seems that Kent would like to deny paleoanthropology, the common right of every science, to the use of hypothetical constructs and theoretical explanations of its observable phenomena. Fossils. I mean, hasn't all sciences exercised free rein for speculation about the causes of what can be observed within their discipline? Of course they have. Okay. Alright, my comments on Christian creationism being propounded as a science. Christian creationism is not a science because there's no causal link between its statements and any observable empirical data. Kent used an analogy in the debate with Massimo as to the evidence that God exists. He said, if I'm walking through the forest and I see a painting, there has to be a designer for the painting. Okay, that's a real nice a priori argument sprinkled with some faith for the existence of a creator. I mean, after all, through our experiences, we have come to reason that things that exist in our world must have a creator. All right? However, there is no causal link between the Christian God and the creation of the world and universe. All right? I mean, I could play the same game and say that in my holy book, Scrum Billyumptious, okay, my God, Peter Steele, created the earth and the universe, and the existence of said earth and universe verifies that it's true. Now, I'll concede that it's difficult to perform experiments in paleontology or paleoanthropology, but there is a causal link between the observable evidence and the theory of evolution itself. Furthermore, evolution is subject to correction, or even to be scrapped entirely if it doesn't fit the available evidence. I suspect that there's no amount of evidence that could accumulate enough for Kant to describe his concept of creationism. So it ain't science. Okay? This leads into the specifics of paleontology as a science. Kent brought up an important issue in the debate with Massimo. To the question of a caller from the debate with Massimo, Kent said, I think Donald Johansson found Lucy 2 weeks before his grant money ran out. I think he found an unusual chimpanzee, which is what Charles Austin said. He studied bones for 16 years through a computer multivariate analysis and said, this is an unusual chimpanzee, this is not a missing link. Now, there are factual errors within this statement that I'll identify, hopefully, in a couple of minutes. However, I want to deal with the thrust of the statement that suggests that Johansson fabricated his findings in some way in order to make himself famous. And indeed, this is exactly what happened in 1912 with Charles Dawson's Piltdown Man. What checks, if any, does science, in general, place to prevent the reporting of fake fossils or discoveries? Errors, blind spots, and biases on the part of individual scientists have always existed in every scientific field. Yet over the course of time, there has been indisputable scientific progress and the growth of objective knowledge in every sphere of science. How has this come about? Progress in scientific knowledge is distilled out of the endeavors of the many individually imperfect scientists who investigate the same phenomenon. The scientific process succeeds in its aim of objectivity in the end, despite the subjective biases of individual scientists. One theory is accepted and one is rejected, not because one scientist was necessarily a better man than the other, but because there's indeed a reality in terms of which theories can be criticized and tested by an innumerable number of scientists, albeit each with his or her own individual biases or blind spots, each scrutinizing and testing the other's formulations. One chief virtue of science is that in order to succeed, its practitioners need not be saints or paragons of detached objectivity. Okay? When many individual scientists, ordinary men and women with specialized technical competencies, are all able to think as they please and do the research unfettered by collectivist or religious constraints, science is a self-correcting process. In any case, whatever general truth the view that scientific knowledge is based on corrupt and biased results can contain, it doesn't exempt the critic from showing exactly how it fails as an objective science, or why it should be rejected or replaced by some other competing formulation. That has always been the normal procedure of science, and we know that it works. In other words, I trust paleoanthropology not because there are no biases or salacious individuals within that field, because indeed we know that there are, but because the checks and balances system of science functions in a way that corrects mistakes. I'm not a paleoanthropologist, so unless I want to become one as a layman, this is what I'm left to believe. Okay? And if Kent wants to become a paleoanthropologist, I invite him to do so. Get out in the field and do some field research. I don't have a single problem with that. All right. Okay. Now, Kent said in his opening statement, faith is required for evolution when we suppose that these fossils of Australopithecines or hominids were able to reproduce. Okay. Now, it's true we've never seen them reproduce, but I have never seen any skeleton of any dead person reproduce either, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. Logic dictates that a fossilized hominid was part of a population of similar organisms that were reproducing. We assume a natural process as opposed to a supernatural process. Now, I think that Kent would say that this requires faith, but the only problem with this is that there is still empirical corroborating evidence that there were no humans of today found within these fossils. But there were skulls of something that didn't look like a man today or like an ape today, but rather something in between that's no longer on Earth, very deep within strata. I think to assume that they couldn't reproduce is more of a leap of faith than assuming that they could. It's simply a more plausible idea given what we know about organisms of today. All right. Another thing that I've got to address tonight is that Kent used a guy named Charles Oxner's research in the last debate. Now, well, in preparation of this debate, I obtained Charles Oxner's book, Fossils, Teeth, and Sex, New Perspectives on Human Evolution, published in 1987 by Washington Press. I have the book right in front of me right now, and it is devoted almost entirely to sexual dimorphism, or in other words, that's allometry, the problem in paleontology, where the sizes of males and females of one species vary at a different rate from different species, and this complicates the identification process. Kent referenced a computer Lucy multivariate analysis on page 227 of this book in the debate with Massimo, and I'm looking on that paper right now, and there is no such thing. Okay, there is a multivariate analysis on page 149, and Oxner simply said that Australopithecines were closer to chimpanzees in sexual dimorphism, which is not inconsistent with what's been said all along. Australopithecus is not homo, Okay, in this book, Oxford has dedicated an entire chapter, chapter 5, to the intervening period African ancestors question mark. On page 123, Oxford states this, and please bear with me, quote, early investigations, Zuckerman 1950, 1955, 1966, 1970, suggest that the Australopithecines are merely fossils whose ape-like features have been de-emphasized by most investigators as they made their human-like assessments. Okay. Later investigations, and I won't bore you with the references here, but Oxford lists his own investigations 12 times. Okay. Later investigations have come to the further conclusion that the individual features of these creatures, whether like apes or humans individually, show what aggregated into an overall pattern anatomical systems that are unique, end quote. Nowhere in this book does Oxnard imply that Australopithecus afarensis was, quote, just an unusual chimpanzee, end quote. And Kent is lying if he says that it does, because I got it right in front of me. The bottom line is that I do not believe Kent even read this book at all, but was rather told that it was Oxnard's work only tangentially debunking afarensis as a human ancestor. Clearly, it does not. And let's see.
30 seconds.
Okay. Okay. All right. Kent talks about a four-year-old can look and see that they're different. It doesn't matter what a layman thinks about evidence for evolution, because a layman does not have the technical skill to measure the skulls, to measure all the evidence, and do some kind of empirical study or mathematical measurement as to whether they're alike or different. Yeah, you can tell to a certain extent of time, but that's not what evolution is all about. It's about gradual, very small changes over a long period of time, of course. And I don't have time to get to my last point of time being the evolution of God, so I'll try to get to that on my summary. And I'll yield back my time.
Okay. All right. Kent Hoven, 10-minute rebuttal, please.
All right. Yes, sir. It's interesting. He mentions the five senses. Of course, that would be a long, interesting discussion. We could talk about the five senses that man has and how on earth could they develop and what evidence is there for them developing. I mean, each one, the sense of sight or hearing or taste or touch, is incredibly complex and I think defies an evolutionary explanation. It goes back to a religion. Well, it's here, so it must have happened kind of thing. You know, they believe it. And I do admire their faith, okay? I wish I had that much faith. I don't think it's based on logic. So he says the five senses and our proper instrumentation is supposed to construct theories based on observation. And he says, I didn't get the exact quote here because I typed kind of slow, but he implied, it seemed to me several times, that evolution is similar to gravity. Well, we can actually see the effects of gravity. I'm using it right now, actually, sitting on the floor, on the chair, which is held down to the floor by gravity. We don't see any of the effects of evolution. You have to imagine. Evolution only takes place in the imagination. To imply that it's like gravity is ludicrous. There is no similarity. Gravity is tested all over the world, and everybody gets the same results. Nobody ever observes anything about evolution. All we see is dogs produce dogs. It happens in China, it happens in Japan, it happens every place, you know, it happens. Dogs produce dogs. Now, he wants to believe, capital B, believe, that it was different long ago and far away. He's right back to what I said at the beginning. Time is the god of the evolutionist. Given enough time, a dog could produce a non-dog. So, to say that evolution is similar to gravity as a theory is absolutely to misunderstand or deliberately misrepresent what the subject is here. He mentioned about the creation, a theory is supposed to give predictions, I believe were the words, I don't get exactly here. Let me just give you the creationist prediction. I believe the world was created in 6 literal days and 24 hours apiece. So I predict we will see symbiosis relationships where certain plants require certain animals and vice versa, and they had to be created within a very short time, like a day or two of each other, or they wouldn't survive. Now, the evolutionists will have to make up a story saying, well, maybe it survived a different way somehow, long ago and far away. You know, for instance, the termites have little parasites in their intestines, and the termites can't live without those little parasites, and the little parasites can't live outside the termite, so obviously the question would be, which one evolved first? That is one of literally billions of symbiosis relationships that could be given in nature that I think absolutely defy an evolutionary explanation. So the creation theory would predict that we would find lots of interrelationship between the animals and plants. Certain plants seem apparently designed for certain animals to pollinate them, and other animals do not pollinate them. All you got to animal world, and you'll see phenomenal design in these creatures. I also predict that, like the Bible says, there was a worldwide flood 4,400 years ago. So I predict because of that flood, we will find strata if we dig down into the earth. The earth will have layers, which happens in any flood with rapidly moving water. The layering would be caused by numerous features like liquefaction, cavitation, simple abrasion, and erosion. You can go to the store and get those things with two pieces of glass and different colored sand in between. And even though you only have two densities of sand, like black and white, when you flip it over, you will make hundreds of layers. It doesn't put all the denser ones to the bottom and all the lighter ones to the top. It makes hundreds of layers of dense and light, dense and light, dense and light, just in a few seconds. You go to the mall and do that. If your mall has those little things, you put them on your desk and flip them over with the different colored sand in there. So I predict, because of the flood, we will find many strata to the earth. I predict we will find them interconnected with trees and other animals, larger animals, petrified in the vertical position, standing up, running through multiple layers of rock strata. And you can see pictures of those on my website, drdino.com, D-R-D-I-N-O, and go to the FAQ, I believe. Is that right, Jonathan? FAQ on frequently asked questions about polystrate fossils. That's correct, okay. And that's exactly what we do find. I predict we'll find fossils. We'll find billions of dead things fossilized in sometimes very contorted positions, even swimming positions. I predict we'll find fish with their gills extended and their fins extended, indicating they're dying in panic mode, dying of suffocation in muddy waters. Those are found by the trillions the herring, for instance, that are found. Literally trillions of them perished in panic mode. This is not the kind of thing you normally get. First of all, you don't normally just get fossils. Just fossils themselves are very unique. And yet it's not an example of this. It's not a problem with finding fossils. There's a problem with finding fossils that support evolution. So the creation model would predict they would find lots of fossils in the ground in strata that are connected in various ways, and the strata are pretty neatly laid on top of each other. They're like pancakes, in most cases, actually. We don't find erosion marks between the strata. No fossil canyons are found, indicating that these strata all formed rapidly on top of each other, precisely like would be predicted by the biblical model of a worldwide flood. And lastly, for the biblical creation predictions, I predict we will find massive canyons in places like Grand Canyon, where the top of the canyon is 4,000 feet higher than where the river enters the canyon. You don't see it because it's spread out over 270 miles, but it's nearly a one-mile rise in 270 miles, and the river enters the canyon in Arizona at 2,800-foot elevation. The top of the Kaibab uplift averages about 7,000 or 8,000-foot elevation. Grand Canyon is a washed-out spillway from a great big lake that overflowed. It is not the result of millions of years of erosion, like the textbook says. The textbook is lying. It is absolutely impossible for the Colorado River to have formed Grand Canyon unless somehow long ago rivers flowed uphill. And, of course, they appeal to the uplift idea that they lifted up slowly over millions of years. Now, you really have to make up a story that as the river cut down the canyon, the ground lifted up at exactly the same rate so it could keep going. No, it was a washed-out canyon, probably washed-out spillway, probably within a few hundred years after the flood. So I think the creation theory does provide predictions which indeed prove to be true. As far as a painting proving a painter, that is just logical common sense. If you go through the woods and you find a building, that proves there was a builder. In paleoanthropology, if they're digging in the ground and they find a simple arrowhead, if they find a rock with a few chip marks on it, they automatically assume it's man-made. Why can they see that it's obviously man-made there, but can't look at their own cell and their own body, which is more complex than the space shuttle, and see that there had to be a creator? There had to be an intelligence behind it. I don't understand why they can't see that. There is an observable link. As far as Johansson, well, we're going to run out of time here. We could talk a long time about Donald Johansson. I have his books also. I believe Donald Johansson claimed he found Lucy, the so-called missing link, and those who studied Lucy say it is not a missing link. If he thinks Lucy was able to produce something other than its kind, then Mr. White believes in something that has simply never been observed. Nobody ever observes any animal produce a different kind of animal. We've never seen that. So it's not science. This is his religion mixed in with science. Now, it is a simple fact that beer is often sold at football games, but beer has absolutely nothing to do with football. And beer does not become athletic by association if you leave it with football long enough. And evolution is thoroughly mixed in our science books, and I'm sorry about that. I'm working on it. I'm trying to fix it. But just because it's mixed in our science books does not make it part of science. Science has a long history of teaching things that are wrong, and old dumb theories die a very hard death. I understand that. That's been the history of science. They think, wow, we've got the truth here, we've got the corner on the market, and nobody's going to change my theory. It was very difficult to change the geocentric theory. It's very difficult to change the phlogiston theory. And they can give hundreds of examples through history. And it's going to be very difficult to change the evolution theory. I understand. But it needs to be changed. It's a ludicrous theory. Somebody wants to believe it, that's fine. I don't care what they believe. But I, for one, and many others join me, saying we resent using this, using tax dollars to support this obviously religious idea in our school system. If he thinks a dog can produce a non-dog, I would like to see the evidence for that. And if he can prove Lucy had any children that lived, I would love to see the evidence for that. You can't prove those bones had any kids that lived. And since the evolutionists want to use our tax dollars, the burden of proof is on them to prove their theory. It's not on me to prove my theory. So that's my final answer.
Okay. We're going to be coming up with the closing remarks in a second, but first a quick announcement here. After these closing remarks here, we're going to have 5 minutes each for both sides, and then we will go into the 30-minute question and answer period, which will be in approximately 10 minutes. And you can call 888-503-0802 with those questions, and each debater will have the opportunity to respond, or they can simply pass that question up, and we'll move on to the next caller. So please hold off your calls until after this period. And after the question and answer period, if we have enough time, we still may allow the debaters to close again after the question, but we'll see how it flows after this. Okay, 5 minutes, Alex.
Yes, sir. Okay. Just a couple of quick rebuttals. Ken said the textbooks say A, B, and C. I didn't write the textbooks. But I tell you what, Mr. Oxnard wrote a book, and I guess Kent needs to reread that book because it certainly didn't say what he said a couple of months ago. Okay, Kent identifies gill slits or other mistakes in paleoanthropology. Okay, in district respect, the early history of every science often looks bizarre in some respects. Why should we expect paleoanthropology to be the great exception? Should we ridicule early astronomers for claiming that the Earth was the center of the universe? Or the early anatomists for claiming that the heart is the seat of emotion. Maybe we should reject medicine as a science because early on, the theory was that a physical fire burned inside human beings and they cut them open to try to see it before it burned out. This actually happened. Okay, how about when doctors performed bloodletting techniques or knocked a hole in the head of a sick person to let the evil spirits out? The list goes on and on. Okay, why should anyone demand paleoanthropology be hatched, fully matured, and perfect from its inception? Okay, just because paleoanthropologists have made mistakes before adequate methodology was developed cannot legitimately be construed as an indictment of all subsequent research in the field. The best Kent can do is lampoon paleoanthropology through its remote historic lineage. Okay, now I'm going to cover premise number two because I didn't get to it, okay? Time being the atheist god. Time is an observable phenomenon, no faith is required, period. When Kent talks about time, it sounds to me like he argues as if time is a fixed thing, something palpable and able to be manipulated. But evolution relies on the progression of time. Time is a process. In my view, the delineation of time is a man-made construct. Man created these measurements called seconds to measure time. Okay, but time happens with or without man's measurement or approval. Okay, at any rate, it's still a natural phenomenon and not supernatural. I know that the awesome progression of time that evolutionists say is required for evolution to occur and produce different, quote, kinds, end quote, of creatures, to quote Kant, from eight similar ones is not observable and cannot be observed by any individual. Historic record wouldn't be available for several reasons. When I say historic record, I mean written historic record here. We have only recently been able to observe organisms change under stress due to improvements in instrumentation. Number two, evolution happened so slowly there wouldn't be anything to observe anyway. And number three, the length of time necessary to cause changes on a genus level of Linnaeus' classifications takes millions of years. Okay? Kent even said it in his debate with Massimo. He believes in evolution on the species level. Okay? A caller called in with this question. He asked, quote, are all horses and donkeys of the same kind, end quote. Kent's response, quote, I believe that they are the original same kind yet. There is diversification over time. Let me read that again, okay, in case you didn't hear it. There is diversification over time. They may not be fertile anymore. They may not produce fertile offspring, but a horse and a zebra and a donkey and some other animals are of the same kind, end quote. Okay, furthermore, the example of DDT demonstrates that crucial characteristics can change in a relatively short time relative to us, changing one species into that, while not different in kind, is distinctly different from what it was before. If a mosquito can change important characteristics within a 7-year time span, it seems reasonable that greater changes could have taken place over a longer period of time. We are able to observe these evolutionary changes in bacteria and mosquitoes because they reproduce very rapidly compared to humans. The reason why, no human has ever witnessed human evolution is because it takes several lifetimes for human evolution to occur. Consider this. If 1 yard were to represent the last 2,000 years, then 3.5 million years is 1,750 yards. That's 10 yards short of a mile. Now, if Kim would like to come over here to Little Rock, Arkansas, I would be more than happy to mark off 1,750 yards and walk it with him in this hot Arkansas sun, and it is hot. While I remind him that every step we take is the length of time that has elapsed since Jesus supposedly walked the earth. I say supposedly because some scholars postulate that Jesus may not have existed, but that's neither here nor there, and it's not within the scope of this debate. Even more specific to our debate tonight is why do no fossils exist of Homo sapiens in the same strata as these half-man, half-ape skeletal remains? I know that Kent's view of the dating scheme of geologic strata is dubious, but still, if modern man was created at the same time as these now extinct ape men, wouldn't modern man be also found in the same strata? I hope that sometime tonight Kent will give us a cogent answer as to that question. Nevertheless, an organism that had characteristics of both man and modern ape was decidedly found, neither one of those were modern man, but something like that was found. It was halfway in between an ape and a man, and they did find that, but they didn't find any normal or regular men of today. Okay? Now, if it's one thing that's been demonstrated tonight, it's that Kent Hovind is not a scientist. He may have taught it, but he doesn't look like he knows what he's teaching. I have given some specific examples that the supporting evidence he refers as evidence for his case is incomplete and inaccurate. And you notice he didn't mention that either. He clearly cannot discriminate between what is faith or religion and what is science. However weak or strong a theory of evolution is, it does have empirical corroborating evidence for which it bases its suppositions. With science, the interpretations of the evidence may differ, but the evidence is still directly observable. With a religion, there is no observable data, which is why you have irreconcilable sects and denominations within religions, and there is never any way to demonstrate corroborating evidence. It also seems clear that Kent has a bias for a supernatural creator and seeks to reject the natural processes for the creation of man. The fact that he presents time has no particular flow, and they're rather a loose collection of aberrations to establish rules that attempt to create order and understanding out of a murky and mysterious origin. Seriously, what motivation do these paleontologists or paleoanthropologists have for debunking a biblical creationism and asserting an evolutionary perspective for the creation of man? Personal fame and fortune? Perhaps. But isn't money tied to just about everything, especially new invention or scientific developments? Of course it is. Don't we want our children to be educated, be it publicly or privately, to use their mind and their understanding of science and technology to make money for themselves? Of course we do. I ask this question. Is it more likely that proponents of creationism are fighting so hard to save our souls, or is it more likely that they are simply fighting to defend one of the oldest operating enterprises in history? Just today I was talking to a colleague of mine about how much money it took to build these beautiful, strong churches in history, how poor everyone else was, yet the church had money to hire the best architects and the best masons to build these awesome structures. Okay, as I recall, scientific knowledge exploded following the Protestant Reformation when church interference was removed from scientific exploration. This is the same science that found a vaccination for smallpox and polio, put men on the moon, and put space stations in orbit around the Earth. And Hubble Space Telescope, for that matter. Science almost always functions better without political or religious interference. Contrary to what Massimo said when he debated Kant, most scientists do not believe in a personal God. Okay, understand that. They do not believe in a personal God. This data comes from a survey published in the science journal Nature by Edward Larson and Larry Witham in 1997. In fact, when a more elite group from the National Academy of Science were polled, only 7% said that they believed in a God. The percentage was less for scientists outside the U.S., and I can give a reference for that tonight. I myself was raised to be a Christian theist and still have lingering aspects of religion in my speech, such as words like God, hell, and holy, although I usually don't use them the same way Kant does. A few years ago, particularly when I studied about religions in a history of civilization course in college, I decided to re-examine my religious views and why I held on to them. After examining available evidence, I made an intellectual decision to abandon faith and leave open the possibilities of how the universe was created. Does a loving God exist? Why do things happen the way they do? If you're an atheist, you've heard this 100 times before. I'll bet you hope there's no heaven or hell, so you won't be sent to the fires of hell. I mean, here's what I usually say to them. I say, you know what? I really hope there is a heaven because I would gladly sacrifice myself to an eternal damnation if that meant that my friends and parts of my family that are believers could go to heaven. And I tell them, and you could too. And I mean that. And that usually gets them thinking. Needless to say, I've converted a few believers to atheism because I tell them that I am happy and just the way I am. I'm a happy and just person just the way I am, and I don't need a God to be happy. With or without religion, people would be happy or depressed, moral or immoral, anxious or patient. There's nothing to be scared of with evolution, and that's all I have. Thank you very much.
All right. I'll let you go a little bit over, so I'll have to, of course, pay the same courtesy to Kent Hovind. You have 8.5 minutes, Mr. Hovind.
All right. Well, thank you so much. There are so many topics here been brought up. It's going to take forever to sort them all out. It would really be better to go point by point instead of minute by minute. Then we could stop each other when we disagree right then while it's fresh in people's minds. He made a statement earlier. He said it doesn't matter what a layman thinks. Basically, blah, blah, blah. Only experts, you know, people trained in the subject are able to properly judge. This is precisely the argument that many false religions have made over the years. You know, only the priests are capable of interpreting the book. You know, you have to have the priest. He's falling into the same trap here that other false religions have fallen into down through history, that they are the only ones who have the authority and the right to judge whether somebody is right or not. And in other words, only evolutionists are able to decide whether evolution is true. That's basically what I got out of it. He said he did not write the textbook. I agree. I did not write it either. However, it is true that evolution theory is taught in the textbooks. I have them in front of me, including the 2003 edition textbooks now from 4 major publishers. It is true that it is taught in the textbooks. It is also true that they use lots of evidence that has been proven wrong to support their theory. He mentioned gill slits, and I find this interesting. He said, early history of every science often looks bizarre. This is not the early history of science. Mr. White, this is modern times. They're teaching this in the 2003 edition textbooks that the human embryo has gill slits. This was made up in 1869 by Ernst Haeckel. It was proven wrong in 1875. His own university held a trial. He finally admitted he lied. He faked to the drawings. The embryology evidence for evolution is wrong. It is a lie. And don't tell me, don't hide behind this idea that it's just the early history and now they've taken it out of the textbook. I'm telling you, they have not taken it out of the textbooks. It is still in there. I'll show it to you. You get the textbooks from your university there in Arkansas. It's still in there. Somebody is lying to the students. They're lying to the kids. They're saying they have evidence for evolution from the geologic column. The geologic column does not exist any place on planet Earth except in the imagination and in the textbooks. They're lying to the students when they say the layers of rock are different ages. They're not. It's easy to demonstrate they're not. We find petrified trees standing up connecting these layers. Go look at my website, drdino.com, go to the FAQ, and you will see it right there. They're lying to the students when they say these minor changes could add up to something major. One of the things we're supposed to be discussing tonight is that time is the god of the evolutionist. In my slow hunt and peck method here, I typed out some of the quotes as quickly as I could for Mr. White. change over 7 years, it seems reasonable that over millions of years, blah, 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 there you go again. You're proving my point. Time is what you are relying on. You said the reason we never observe evolution is because it takes several lifetimes, blah, blah, blah. There we go again. I think you're on my side. I think you're admitting that time is the god of the evolutionist. You mentioned that there are examples of half man, half ape. You never gave one. I'd like to see these, and I'd like to see the actual bones, not the reconstructions after somebody gets done. They gave one Neanderthal skull to 9 different artists. The article was in Time magazine, and said, what did this guy look like? They got 9 different answers, ranging all the way from nearly exactly like us today, human, to very, very ape-like creatures. It's all in the imagination of what would you like it to look like? Or how old do you think it is? So that'll determine how ape-like it should be. They start with the assumption evolution is true, and then make all the fossils fit the assumption. You said Kent Hovind is not a scientist. Well, I'd like to first of all decide, or tell you, have you tell me sometime, who decides who's a scientist? You better look it up in the dictionary. A scientist is a person who studies science. And I study science. I think what you're trying to do, and what many others try to do, is say, if you don't believe in evolution, you're not a scientist. And therefore, all scientists believe in evolution. That doesn't take too long to figure out the flaw in that logic. You said Kent Hovind has a bias for a creator. I agree. I believe the evidence is overwhelming. There must have been a designer. Now, who was this designer? Was it Allah or Buddha or Jehovah? Well, that's an entirely different set of arguments. But the fact is, there must have been a designer. Just like if you're walking through the woods and you find a painting hanging on a tree, there must have been a painter. I can't say who it was, but I'm just telling you there must have been one. And I think there must have been a designer because everything we see is so complex. I will say the evolutionist also has a bias that there was not a creator. He starts with the assumption, okay, there must be a naturalistic explanation. You cannot appeal to the supernatural. Then they go on hunting around the world trying to find this natural explanation. Suppose I said to you, Mr. White, I would like you to explain to me how computers came to be, but you cannot use man as your answer. You must use a purely natural explanation for how computers arose. If I've already ruled out the only logical explanation at the beginning, and if you allow me to define the terms of the debate, I'll win. Because you cannot give me a naturalistic explanation of how computers came to be. And you're trying to rule out the only logical explanation that there must have been a designer at the beginning, and then sit back and say, ah, well, see, therefore science is dealing with the natural explanation, you know, and we're still looking for the answer. Well, you've ruled out, you've closed half the doors before you even start the research. Just try it with a computer sometime. Just try your own same logic. You said, what motivation do paleoanthropologists have? I think they have a motivation to keep their grant money coming in, number one, because if you even try to go against the established, you know, the holy cow of evolution, if you try to publish a paper that doesn't support the evolution theory, it won't be published. I've got people on my staff that are from Russia, and they can tell you very clearly that in the Soviet Union, 10 or 15 years ago, if a teacher got up in their class and said, okay, kids, I don't believe in communism. I think capitalism is a better system, or whatever. They would lose their job, if not their life, and lose their freedom. They'd be off shoveling snow in Siberia if they survived. And what we have in America is a situation where professors get exiled to, you know, academic Siberia if they don't support the evolution theory. They won't give their grant money. You could ask Dean Kenyon at San Francisco State University, who was a tenured professor, wrote books on evolution, and then one day decided, you know, I've been writing books on this. I'm the poster boy for evolutionists. There's no evidence. And he became a creationist. They fired him. Finally, after he sued because he was tenured, he got his job back as a lab assistant, washing test tubes. It was real religious discrimination against somebody who didn't support the evolution theory. Forrest Mims was denied the job as science writer because he was a creationist, even though he'd published in all the major magazines, National Geographic and others. He had already published in there, but they said, no, we don't want a creationist on the staff. I cover quite a few examples of this on my videotape number 7, if you care to watch that. So I think paleoanthropologists have a motivation. They're called peer pressure. They're afraid of what their friends are going to think. They're afraid of losing their grant money, because it does happen. If you don't support evolution, you're exiled to academic Siberia. And you mentioned how much money it took to build churches. Well, how much money did it take to build Harvard or Princeton or Yale or the university where you teach? How much tax money have you guys spent to spread your religion? It's private people using their private money to build the churches. It is evolutionists using public money to build their churches, the universities, to teach about their God. He said science exploded when the church was taken out. Well, you don't understand the history of science. all the major branches of science were started by creationists. And you said, most scientists do not believe in a personal God. I don't know if that's true or not, but it doesn't matter. Majority opinion is meaningless. What is truth is what's the matter. What people believe in, and it's interesting you use the word believe. You have to believe in evolution. Evolution's a religion. I think I've proven both points in the debate here tonight. He relies on time, and he believes things happen, but he doesn't prove they happen. He's a religious zealot, not a scientist. And that's my final answer.
Okay. All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate that. We're going to now move on to the question and answer period. For those of you listening, just tuned in, don't forget to join us in the chat room. Okay, it's infidelguy.com or atheistnetwork.com. We're all gathering in there right now. We have a couple of individuals in here who agree with Gent Hovind, and we have quite a number of people who disagree. So, and there's some heated discussions going on here, so please call in 888-503-0802. If you're having difficulty getting through, just go ahead and just hang up and hit redial and keep trying, okay? Because if it's busy, that means someone's asking their question. As soon as you call in and ask your question, I'm going to hang up immediately so that you can listen off air and allow someone else to call in. Callers, when you do call in, you may hear either Kent Hovind or Alex White answering a question. Just please hold tight, don't say a word, and then I'll let you on as soon as you can. Okay, well, until we get these until the phone calls start coming in, because there's a little delay here via the internet broadcast, I guess I'll ask one question. And actually, there's a question for both of you. I guess I'll first start with Alex White. What evidence would it take for you to believe that God exists?
I would believe that God exists if I saw a miracle. And now, when I say a miracle, I mean something that was something that could not be explained by a natural process or a natural phenomenon. That's it. If I see that, hey, you got me. I'm going to church, man. That's all there is to it.
Okay. And this is a similar question for Kent Hovind. What evidence or what would it take for you to disbelieve in God?
Well, I think they'd have to extract about 80% of my brain to make me not believe there's a God. I think it's logical. You look around and say, hey, there must have been a designer. This place is just too complex. I think the more I study biology or physical science or earth science, everything to me points to a designer from the cellular level clear up to the stellar level. The stars seem to be organized in galaxies. The planets are organized going in nice orbits. Everything in your body, even the electrons are organized going around the nucleus. I don't see how you could. You can't prove a negative. You can't prove the non-existence of something. So I think it's not logical to say that that something is non-existent based on any evidence. I don't think that'd be a logical fallacy.
Oh. Okay. Just like no one's called in yet, although someone was ringing up the hook earlier. Again, the number is 888-503-0802. Spread the word in the chat room. Let everyone know that the question and answer period has indeed begun. Okay, appreciate it. Brian in the chat room, go ahead and post that for me. I really appreciate it. Oh, we got a call calling in right now. Okay, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good evening. I have a question. First of all, I really appreciate both of the gentlemen's time this evening, and I really I think it's been one of the more intelligent, mostly controlled debates that I've heard. I'd like to ask Mr. Hovind, because I really wish that there was more diversity of opinion, what is the alternative? Let's just assume that everything you said about evolution is true, and it's all basically crazy, and it's all based on faith, and we need a more rational explanation of how we got here. I grew up with Christianity, reading Genesis every week, and what I got was an unseen, unknowable being by unknowable processes somehow caused all of this to come out of nothing. And I'd like to hear, what I'd really like to get at is, Mr. Hovind, in your life, what has believing this, what difference has that made? Instead of everything happening by accident, it happened for a purpose, but by somebody we'll never see, and we don't know how.
That was a rather long, convoluted question. I lost track of it just a little bit there. Shorten it down just for a second for me. What difference would it make in my life? I understand that. For the first part?
Yes. You reject evolution because it doesn't seem plausible to you, and it doesn't satisfy your need for a cause for the universe.
Oh, what substitute would I offer?
Well, I think you're very clear about what substitute you offer is the account in Genesis, and to me that account in Genesis is an invisible being by unknowable processes that caused the universe. And I want to know what difference has believing that made in your life rather than dealing with the Earth as if it all just happened.
Okay. Well, first place, I do deal with the Earth. I think both of us, the creationists and the evolutionists, are observing the exact same evidence. It's not like one is blind. We're both seeing the same thing. We're just coming to different conclusions. Let's suppose we're going to set up an argument where two computers are arguing with each other, does man exist? And these two computers are talking back and forth through the Internet or whatever, and they're saying, well, look, I can't see him. We are pretty complex, but after all, we're nothing but natural components. And they can argue till they're blue in the face, or in the screen, or whatever. They can't prove man exists. One of them's going to say, you think some invisible being outside of the computer created us, ha ha ha. Mm-hmm. When yet, if you frame the argument to say only naturalistic explanations are allowed, you are not going to be able to explain how computers came to be, or cars came to be, or any complex thing came to be.
Okay. Alex White, do you want to respond to that as well?
Yeah, sure. The reason why we have evolution, as far as evolution means literally to evolve, means literally to change over time. That's what I mean. Now I know that the theory of evolution has come to mean some other things, but I accept the theory of evolution as far as the changing of organisms from something very basic to something that is now very complex. The reason why I accept that is because it is simply the most plausible explanation based on the empirical, observable evidence that we have today. I mean, it's not perfect. I wish it was. I wish we did have an answer, to the origin of man. And I really wish we did. I wish someone would just tell us, and we could just dispense with all this. But that's simply the most plausible explanation. I'm sorry we can't do better than that. But that's just the way that science operates.
Okay.
One more thing. Kent uses a computer. You know, you talk about a computer, one computer talking to another, blah blah blah. You know, the thing is that if there were some, I agree with the caller. If there were some empirical evidence to support a creator or that these create, I don't know, that the computers were created by supernatural power. If there were some empirical connection to that, then okay, then I would accept that. But like I said in my opening statement, if you have empirical evidence, it's not faith. And there is empirical evidence for evolution.
Okay, let's take the next caller. You're on.
I'm on?
Yep.
Okay, cool. This is for Mr. White. You said you didn't work in psychology, right?
I do work in psychology. I mostly give IQ tests.
Okay, so my question, I guess, is posed towards you. I don't know if you could answer this, but in a random universe, if there is no creator, no God, no governing force that's basically running everything, then how do we explain consistent thoughts? I mean, if I'm in a random universe, how can I even trust what I'm thinking? It could just be another random explosion, right?
No, we trust what's observable to the five senses. I mean, the thing is, the difference between Kent, myself, or you and myself is that you believe whatever comes in through your five senses, that you're able to arrange into your mind, and I hope I'm answering your question here. I think I understand it. We arrange it in our minds, and then we formulate thoughts. And okay, it takes a physical brain to do that. Let's keep that in mind. I lost my train of thought there for a second. How do we know? Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. The thing that Ken and I have in common is that we both accept these things as factual. We both accept, or I assume he does, I would imagine that he does. We accept things in the physical world as being, quote, actual, factual things. Okay? But the difference between myself and a theist is that they believe something else. They believe an additional thing, and that additional thing is that there was a supernatural being or a supernatural creator that is somehow working. amendments to go along with that, then I'd jump on board.
Okay.
Let me make one comment on that. I think he either misunderstood the caller's question or dodged it. I think the question, as I understood it, was if the universe is really random and the result of an explosion, how do you know your thoughts are not random and explosions? And if this began as randomness, why are the laws not random? Why doesn't gravity change from time to time? Why is it, you know, why don't you weigh 10 pounds more a few seconds from now? And, you know, why are the laws so consistent? Why are thoughts so consistent? And how can you trust these if indeed everything is random?
Indeed.
That's what he was asking, and I'd love to get an evolutionist to answer that one.
That's interesting. I'll let the comment on that real quick before I take the next caller. You know, I was thinking, well, I mean, if you're saying that random explosions and whatnot can't generate thoughts, it makes you kind of beg the idea that then if you believe that there's a God that determines your thoughts, then you're just a robot, and you don't really have any free will anyway. So that kind of leads to that, I would think, in some way. But
well, I don't know anybody who's ever said God determines your thoughts. I mean, don't put those words in my mouth.
I think
God knows our thoughts, but I don't think he determines them. So that's, I think you're setting the straw man there.
Oh, no, we can debate that another time. Okay.
Just a quick response. I know our how do we know that our thoughts aren't random? I guess we really don't, do we?
Very good.
I guess we really don't. We this is the same brain that has put satellites into space. We're basically at the top of the food chain. I mean, we've done some amazing things with this brain. So, that's why I assume that it is a reasonable operating mechanism.
But if you're going to use that logic, I would go back and point out that all of the major branches of science were started by creationists. The vast majority of the population of the world believes that there's a creator. They have different ideas of what he's like. So if we're going to trust the brain, then the majority is on my side, not on your side.
Okay, but those creationists were unfettered by any kind of political or in their endeavor to work with science, they were unfettered by any other kind of interference. And that was my point that I made about science. I think you misunderstood that part of it.
All right, gentlemen, let's move on to the next caller, please. You're being rude to the next questioner here. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you both for a great debate, first of all. And I'd like to put forth a question for both of the debaters, and I'll take the answer offline. I was just curious what both of their stances were on unused organs in the human body. And that's it. I'll take it offline.
All right. Did you both understand the question before?
I believe I did.
Okay.
I'd like to hear your answer, Mr. White.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Well, I think I actually tangentially answered the question anyway. To me, that's a good question. I mean, why do we have a appendix? You know, did some creator put this thing in us just to irritate a few people? I mean, I think that vestigial organs, appendix, in the corner of our eye, we have something called a nictitating membrane, this little ball that's in the corner, in the inside corner of our eye. Now, this is the same thing that covers the eyes of, like, frogs and mostly aquatic creatures. And, this, why do we have this piece of evolutionary trash in the corner of our eye that we don't need and we don't use? I mean, I think those kind of vestigial organs are an excellent, an excellent evidence or support for an evolutionary theory of the adaptation of man.
Owen?
All right. I think anyone who believes there are vestigial organs is way behind on their science. There used to be a list, I think it was 130 years ago, of 180 vestigial organs, things the body no longer needs. That list has been whittled down to zero. The appendix is not a vestigial structure. It is necessary. It's part of the immune system for the lower colon. You can look it up in any modern dictionary, encyclopedia, or medical book, and it'll tell you the appendix is not vestigial. As far as the nictitating membrane, that's an essential part of the eye. It may not do much, just like, you know, little things on your car may not do much, but they may be very necessary. And you may be able to survive by pulling out one spark plug wire and still drive your car. And you can survive without an appendix. You can also survive without both your legs and both your arms and both your eyes and both your ears. That does not mean you don't need it. To argue that vestigial organs, and there aren't any, first of all, there are no vestigial organs. You need everything you got. Now, the fact that you can live without them is evidence of the incredible design. You could live with four of your fingers cut off, and you could probably still use your hand to some extent. So what? That doesn't prove it's... To say that is evidence of evolution the logic there.
If you have a reference for that appendix as a useful organ, I'd love to have one. Not one of those Charles Ostner references that are occasionally inaccurate.
Okay.
Can you give me a good reference where the...
Grolier's Encyclopedia, 1998 edition, I believe, is where it mentioned... let's see, I've got my... It'll take me a second to get there. I've got 6,000 slides. I cover this on videotape number 4, where I cover all some of the lies in the text.
How much does that cost?
Pardon me?
How much does that videotape cost?
Well, the whole series is $99, and you can copy it and then return it and get your money back.
Oh.
I defy you to find any evolutionist that has that policy, and that's been my policy for 15 years.
Well, that's a fact. I may buy one.
Okay.
Oh, well,
the appendix, let's see.
I can't hold on. I'll give you 15 seconds. We've got to take this call.
Grolier Encyclopedia, 1998. Here's the quote from Roy Hartenstein. He said, long regarded as a vestigial organ with no function in the human body, the appendix is now thought to be one of the sites where immune responses are initiated. End of quote.
Okay.
I've known this for a long time. So just because we don't understand the use of something doesn't mean we don't need it. Put a 5-year-old under the hood and say, here, tell me, spell out whatever you don't think a car needs. He may not think it needs a lot of things that it really needs.
All right, let's take this call. Go ahead, please.
Yes, this is Glenn Patterson, and I think it's what one question per caller?
Well, it's just one question, and they're both going to address it.
Okay. Anyway, this is Dr. Hovind. You mentioned about Dr. White's uses of the term time and his explaining the length of time. And use basically, what I'd like to know is how does Dr. White's usage of time make time a god using the standard definition of God?
Okay. The creationist says God created the universe. The evolutionist says, well, given enough time, the universe can create itself. Either way, you still have this entity called time, which is very difficult to define, by the way, giving credit for doing something that we don't observe happening. He thinks if we had enough time, the unseen would become seen. So, just like I appeal to the unseen God, he appeals to the unseen time to do that which has never been observed. Okay? I think if you replay the tape from tonight, you'll find many times he refers to the concept of, if we had millions of years, we would observe these things happen. I mean, he's mentioned that probably at least 15 times in the last hour. So, he believes it'll happen if you give it enough time. I believe time is his scapegoat. Time is the thing he hides behind. We don't observe it in the modern world. Dogs are only producing dogs. Now, he believes they came from a non-dog a long time ago, but there you go, back to time. Time is the god.
You want to respond to that, Alex?
Yeah, first of all, I'm not a doctor. I have a master's degree. I want to make that clear. When I say that I'm a psychologist, I mean lowercase d, not capital D. I want to make sure I clear that up. That's ethical for my field. Time, I can't really make a good analogy here, but if you observe something happening, a small change over a small period of time, and you can do that. We observe DDT, the resistance to DDT. We observe antibiotics, bacteria becoming resistant to antibiotics. We see that all the time. Now, if you can see something observable like that, and I alluded to that earlier tonight, if you can see something small happen, then it is scientific to make interpretations based on what you've already seen. We make inferences based on what is observable, and all branches of science have done that.
Okay.
Well, let me prove my point again.
Well, let's take
time one more time.
There we go. All right, you're on the air. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, this is Brian. My comment and question is for Kent. Kent, you've made a lot of references to high school textbooks and other books, and from what I've heard, Mr. White has shown that there's no veracity to your quotes or the things you quote out of high school textbooks. I don't know why we should take your word now on the Gilfoots and the new 2003 high school textbooks.
Okay, was that a question you would like me to prove where it is?
Yeah, what is your question?
I'm holding in my hand Prentice Hall biology book by Miller, 2003 edition, where he shows the picture of the
Gilfoot. That's the last day. It says that wasn't in his college book. And,
No, this is a high school textbook. I just got these last week.
That's right, I know, but that's not a college book.
Okay.
And Mr. White has shown that there's no veracity to your quotes
regarding possible sex. I don't know why we should take your word.
You don't have to take my word. Listen to me carefully. Prentice Hall, major publisher, I think the largest one in America, biology textbook. It has a dragonfly on the front of it. It's by Miller and Levine. Turn to page 385, where Miller is still talking about embryology as being evidence for evolution. This is a 2003 edition. This was proven wrong in 1875. Miller has been told this many times. I debated him on the radio several years ago. He teaches in Rhode Island at Brown University. He refuses to take it out of his book. He's lying to students that are reading his book, trying to give them evidence for evolution when there isn't any. So don't accuse me of misquoting, okay? You did not prove that I misquoted anything. I just read you the page number, and I looked it up in all four. I have one here by Glencoe Science Biology. I have the sixth edition biology by Raven and Johnson by McGraw-Hill in front of me. And I have the Holt biology by Johnson and Raven used in all of these are 2003 editions. Jonathan, help me look these up about embryology. I don't like anybody accusing me of lying. If you watch my website or watch my videotapes, you can watch them right online. I use over 6,000 visuals in PowerPoint. Just about every one of them is referenced right at the bottom. You can look it up for yourself. So I resent you implying that I'm misquoting something. But I work very hard to quote this properly.
All right. Alex, any response to that?
Yeah, apparently he's not working hard enough because I'm looking at page 227. Now, I'll read him the page if he lies. I mean, if we have enough time, I'll read him the page. And nowhere on here does it say Lucy Computer Multivariate Analysis. Like I said, there was some kind of reference to that on page 149, but as I said before, it was not it did not debunk evolution or any kind of assumption within evolution. I'm inclined to agree with the caller. I mean, if you're going to make quote references and you're going to quote textbooks, then it's scientifically ethical. I know that to be accurate with your quotes. I mean, I don't know, you know, what Mr. Oxford thinks, but man, I mean, I don't know what the laws are, but man, you're potentially opening yourself up for some slander when you misquote a text, when you misquote someone's book like that.
Okay, first place, the reference I have is from the 1987 edition. And
that's what I got.
You said 1985 when you mentioned earlier, and it's 277 is the page that I was given. Now listen, if there's a mistake, I assure you, I will correct it. If I can show you that there's a mistake in your textbooks, if they're using lies to support evolution, will you work to extricate those things from the textbook? If your textbook in University of Arkansas is teaching the embryo has gill slits, will you be intellectually honest and work to have that removed, yes or no?
Absolutely.
Good. Well, then I'm going to order a copy of the book used for Teach Biology at the university. Which one? You at Central Arkansas?
You can get one from Central Arkansas. I attend the Dayton University as well.
Okay.
I do not represent the views of the University of Arkansas, Central Arkansas.
I want to make sure I understand now. Right. If I can show you some things that are used in the textbooks, even other than gill slits, if I can show you some things that are totally incorrect and have been demonstrated incorrect numerous times, but they're still in there as evidence, you will work to get those removed. Is that what you're telling us?
Absolutely.
Okay, y'all heard it, folks.
Let's take this next call. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, this is D. Damage.
I can't hear you. Can you speak up a little bit?
Hi, yeah, this is D. Damage from the board.
All right,
I have a question for Kent Hovind based on a geological question here.
Okay.
Based on the evidence that the geologists have as to the tectonic shift and the time that it takes for a continent to drift from one position to the next, how can you possibly determine that our Earth is 5,000 years old when it takes so much longer for Pangaea to form to our current state?
Okay, he was very soft. I think I got the question right. He says, based on the time it takes for continents to shift from Pangaea, how can I say it takes, you know, the Earth is only 6,000 years old? Is that basically what he's asking?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first place, I don't believe in the Pangaea theory. I don't believe it's demonstrable. I think the fact that some continents seem to fit if you move them together on a globe, it means nothing. I think opposite sides of nearly all rivers are parallel with each other, but that does not prove they broke apart and the water oozed up between them. I think if you look at a map of Pangaea, you'll discover they removed all of Mexico and Central America. You'll find they twisted Africa one way, and they twisted Europe and South America a different way. I think you'll find they shrank Africa at least 35% in order to make them fit. The shapes of the continent is a pure coincidence based on the water level. If you take all the water out of the oceans, you will notice there is dirt underneath. The continents are still connected right this minute. They've always been connected. I do think they're moving. I taught earth science for 15 years. I've studied many of the major fault lines in America. I love the subject of geology and plate tectonics. I think they're moving. However, the fact that they're moving a little bit, not as fast as your fingernails grow, does not in any way prove that it took millions of years. If I see somebody on Interstate 10 headed east in Pensacola, headed toward Jacksonville, that does not prove he started in Los Angeles, where Interstate 10 begins. So what they're doing is they're observing continents moving a little bit, and I agree. I've been in earthquakes. I've climbed all over the San Andreas Fault. I've been to the Golden Fault, the New Madrid Fault. I agree they happen. I think I understand basically what everybody else understands about what causes them to happen. However, to assume that that is somehow proof that Earth is billions of years old, absolutely, that logic wouldn't hold up 2 seconds in a court of law. You haven't demonstrated the Earth is old. Because we see the continents move slowly now, therefore we can interpret billions of years in here. That is ridiculous.
Okay. Alex White?
Yeah, I would just say to the caller, if you want to know about plate tectonics, I would suggest you go to those who have skilled technical competencies in that field and read a book about that and refer to them for theories or concepts based on plate tectonics. I'm unfortunately not as skilled, I don't do any research in that area, and therefore I'm not going to make any comment about what the cause or the theory on that.
Okay.
I don't feel like I am
qualified on that.
Right.
Okay, excellent. We have another caller just called in. Go ahead, please, Junior.
Hi. I had a two-part question for Mr. Hovind. First of all, I'd like to know how I can tell if two beings are of the same kind. And secondly, I'd like to know how I can tell if two beings are not of the same kind.
Okay. Let me write this down here. I think in most cases, a 5-year-old can tell you if certain animals, let's just stick with animals instead of plants to make it easy, okay? Though we could do the same with plants. I think in most cases, a 5-year-old can tell you where the dividing line is in the different kinds. If I threw 50 animals out in the field and said, okay, kid, which ones are the same kind? I think he'd be able to quickly recognize that a horse and a turtle are not the same kind. A horse and an elephant are not the same kind. I think just about most of the cases would be just obvious to anybody with an IQ equivalent to a 4-year-old, okay? Now, there may be a few cases where it is tough. I understand that. And that would be a very legitimate function of biology to study. Hey, are these animals the same kind? For instance, is a fox in the dog family? I don't know. I suspect it is, but I think that's a legitimate question. And I think we could do all sorts of research, like DNA research, to determine, are they similar that way? If there are similarities in DNA, that doesn't prove they have a common ancestor necessarily. Or it might prove they have a common creator. But I would say, I'll tell you what, you send me a couple of examples, and I'll tell you if I think they're the same kind. Now, and if not, if they originally were able to reproduce, they certainly are the same kind. Now, you may get a situation like you have with the Florida rabbits and the Alaska rabbits where they cannot reproduce. The Alaska rabbits can breed with the Minnesota rabbits, and the Minnesota rabbits can breed with the Florida rabbits, is my understanding. But the two extremes, the Florida and the Alaska rabbits, cannot breed together and produce viable offspring. So they are different. They're classified as different species or subspecies, and yet it's very obvious to a 4-year-old they're both still rabbits. They're the same kind. So the Bible definition is very simple, and I think foolproof. If they could bring forth, they were the same kind.
Right.
Now, they may have branched off and diversified over the years into, you know, not interbreedable. A Great Dane and a Chihuahua, except for a few mechanical problems, are still interfertile and can still breed and produce viable offspring. A Great Dane and a pine tree cannot. A Great Dane and a turtle cannot. A Great Dane and an elephant cannot. So I think most of them would be obvious to anybody. There may be a few difficult spots, and I'd certainly be willing to do that. I think the platypus and animals like that would very obviously be their own kind.
All right. What's the second part of the question, please?
And how to tell if they're not the same kind? Well, if they never were able to reproduce, if they never were of the original breeding kind, then you know that there's been a barrier in there all along.
Right.
Hamsters do not breed with elephants.
Hamsters
do not breed with squirrels.
Yeah. Excuse me, Colin. Did you ask both questions already?
That was it.
Okay, my bad. I guess he, I didn't realize he hung up there. Okay, we'll open the lines back up. I'm sorry. Okay. Alex, do you have a...
Yeah, I would just say, you know, same kind. You know, Kent seems to make up his own classification system here. I don't know that anyone would say that hamsters and elephants are the same kind, but I know that they're higher up on Linnaeus' classification of organisms than just species. I mean, I don't know whether it's order or family or whatever, but I know that they're higher up than species. And I know in the debate with Massimo, Kent kind of, it sounded like kind was kind of analogous with species. But like I said, the classification system just doesn't really fit.
Okay, I would say there may be some cases where the kind, the biblical kind, and our modern classification of species are indeed the same. I would say probably there may be some cases where it'd be more like family or genus. But I think the fact that we classify things a certain way today does not mean anything as far as how God originally classified them. A classification system, at best, is our superimposing some of our ideas over the top of what we observe in the animal world.
True.
So, I mean, that's purely arbitrary.
There is a lot of arbitrariness to it. I'll concede that point to you. But you know, if there's some organisms, I mean, you know, this whole kind theory, you know, maybe I should, I think I'll give my email address to Mr. Finley and I'll have him give it to you, because I truly like a cogent definition of kind. And you know, you said sometimes these animals are the same kind, and sometimes they're not the same kind. I can't really get a handle on exactly what a kind is.
Well, I can't get a handle on exactly what a species is when a dog and a wolf are different species, but they can still interbreed.
Right, but they don't. But like I said, see, the definition of species is not what you just said. If they don't reproduce in nature, then they're not the same species. That is what determines a species.
Well, then you're missing the point. You have a very flexible definition of the word species.
Exactly.
Why are exactly correct?
Right.
Why are dog and wolf classified as a different species when they are?
Hey, don't. I just answered your question.
Yeah, but I don't think you realize the folly of your answer. They would still obviously be the same kind, and every 5-year-old knows that a dog and a wolf are the same kind of animal. And probably you could start over today with 50 wolves and breed, and over a period of X number of generations, develop dogs.
I don't think you know what a species is. I think that you're confused as to what a species is.
I don't think you do either, and I don't think anybody does.
I can define it for you right here, and I think I've already done so. If you want, I'll mail you my opening remarks.
I defined what a kind is very clearly. Those that originally were able to reproduce are the same.
Originally from what?
Pardon me?
Originally from what?
From the original creation. God brought them, God designed them to bring forth after their kind.
Okay.
If you could prove an example scientifically where a dog ever produced a non-dog, or a dog came from a non-dog, I would like to see it. But I think the empirical evidence points to the biblical testimony as being literally true.
Okay. You're free to interpret the evidence however you would like, but the people that have skilled technical competence in the field do not agree with you.
You're doing exactly what the Catholics do, that only the priest is able to interpret the evidence. They're doing exactly the same thing. Only the high priests of evolution are capable of interpreting the evidence.
You can become a paleontologist, can you not?
Oh, you can become a Catholic priest too, but see, you are nothing but a religious zealot pushing your faith.
if you want to call it that, then that's fine with me. But like I said, evolution is the only explanation for the origin of man that has empirical, observable evidence that you can measure on this planet. And everything else is just fake.
Evolution is the only naturalistic.
All right, gentlemen, let's take this last call here, then we'll wrap this debate up. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I have a question. I'm really curious and intrigued by your whole theory on dragons. I'd like to hear a little bit more about it and know what your proof is. You talk about fossil records, and I just was interested in dragons in the colder parts of the world, like in England and Russia, where they supposedly slayed them you're talking about. I just want to know more about your dragons.
I assume the question is to me.
Yeah.
I think you could find in the literature, ancient literature, hundreds of references to dragons. People slaying dragons or being afraid of dragons or whatever, and I have quite a collection of those references from ancient literature. I think you'll find the word dragon mentioned 35 times in the Bible, if you look it up, which may not matter to some people, but it's a fact, it's there. And I think if you look at this from a creationist perspective, that everything was created in 6 days. This would include dinosaurs. The Bible teaches that before the flood came, the people lived to be over 900 years old. there are many ancient cultures, from the Babylonians to the Sumerians to other cultures, that teach there was a golden age when man used to live to be 1,000. Over 1,000. That's what they teach. So I think they got that from the biblical, from the truth, that they lived over 900 years. Well, reptiles never stop growing. So in the Garden of Eden conditions, reptiles would grow 60 or 70 feet long. And so dinosaurs, though that word was not made up until 1841, dinosaurs were just big lizards. They were called dragons all through history. It's a simple fact. There are lots of legends of these things. There are lots of historical accounts. They were there. We are not. So for somebody in the 20th or 21st century to look at a dragon legend and say, well, they're stupid, we're smart, that is egotistical. The fact is, like I said, they were there. I've got coins in our museum here from 1602 and 1608 and 1611 that clearly show people slaying dragons. There are just lots and lots of references to this. So somebody can, you know, poo-poo the whole thing and say, well, they're just ignorant and we're modern science, you know, we're smart. But I think, historically, there were dragons. And I think people killed most of them for lots of various reasons. Just like people nearly killed, you know, they killed all the grizzly bears in Florida. Nearly killed all the crocodiles or alligators, you know. People exterminate things that they're bigger than them or they're afraid of.
All right, hold on.
History of man for hundreds of years.
Right. Well, thank you for your response to that one. And Alex, I'll let you go ahead and answer this question, and we're going to end the debate after this.
Sure. I would like to hear Kent's answer. Where can we find what books are there? What references can you provide that dragons and well first of all, are alligators big lizards?
Alligators are certainly big lizards. They're in the reptile family.
Okay.
Now, as far as references, about 50,000 stones were found in burial mounds in Ica, Peru. I have four of them in my museum here. They're called the Ica burial stones. They were first discovered in 1946. These clearly show people and dinosaurs together. We have four. You can come see them in Pensacola, Florida. You can go to my, Jonathan, are those pictures on our website of our Ica stones? Yeah, they're on there. Okay, under the question section.
Can you give me, I'm sorry, I'll refresh. Can you give me an outside reference other than your website where I can read about this?
Well, go to any university library and look up dragons. Go to the QL89 if it's the Dewey system. I mean, if it's the...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I guess I'd like to jump in this, too, since it's the last 5 minutes of the program here. Mr. Hovind, so you're saying that there are depictions of these Indians with, you said these dragons, and that's your evidence that dragons existed back then? Or
that is one of my evidence.
Okay.
That's all I had time for.
Okay, well, what about let's address in Egypt. The inscriptions and whatnot in the pyramid, they depict these gods with dog heads and various animal heads and whatnot. Do they exist just because someone depicted them on a wall?
I don't know. I don't think so. But that doesn't disprove the other. You got really flawed logic there, okay?
Uh-huh. All it is, ask a question.
The fact that there are so many depictions of dragons from cultures unrelated all over the world, to me the accumulation of evidence is much greater than the accumulation of silly evidence we heard tonight about evolution.
And you said Inca, right? So the Inca?
I-C-A.
Right.
Lima, Peru, and go south east about 7-hour drive to the town of Ica, I-C-A. Dr. Kabara just died, but he's a medical doctor from Lima. He spent years collecting these stones. He has 11,000 in his collection.
And how old are these again?
These from the desert varnish accumulated on the rock. He studied these for 30-some years and concluded they have to be about the time of Christ, plus or minus 500 years.
Wow.
They're -500 BC to 500 AD.
Wow.
The Inca civilization. That's just one. Go to drdino.com and go to the picture of the dinosaur that washed up on the beach in California in 1925. People came and examined it from all over and said, man, that's a plesiosaurus laying on the beach in Monterey, California. At a neck 20 feet long. I've had some idiots to contact me and say, oh, that's a whale. I said, yeah, show me the neck on a whale.
Or a basking shark.
Show me the neck on a basking shark. The people who examined it said the skin was intact completely around the neck. It was not a rotting carcass of a basking shark.
Where are the pictures of this? At your website?
You can see pictures of it clearly on my website, or there's a book called Shipwrecks and Sea Monsters of California Central Coast.
I heard of that.
Well, see, you've been studying the wrong stuff. You need to get into creationist literature. There's a lot of good stuff in there.
Well, all right, gentlemen, I'd like to say thank you very much, and thanks to the audience for participating and calling in and whatnot. Please join us in the chat room. I don't know if either you, Mr. Hovind, or your son has time, if you want to join us in the chat room, and we can carry on this conversation and whatnot, and we'll definitely send some people checking out your website.
I do have an option to the chat room. I simply don't have time to do that. I speak 800 times a year, but My radio program, truthradio.com, we welcome any atheists or skeptics to call in. It's on an hour long every day.
Oh, excellent. Can possibly I can appear as a guest? Or...
Oh, yeah. DrDino.com, just click the button Truth Radio, and you can send a message, or you can call right in. It's every weekday, except this next week I'll be flying to speak in Alaska, so I'm only, that's going to be taped programs, but normally I'm on the air live.
All right. Well, once again, thank you both for appearing, and
my pleasure.
Definitely keep in touch. Thank you again.
Me too. Do it again anytime.
All right. Good night.